This podcast is brought to you by Lannan Foundation, available at podcast.lannan.org. Alistair MacLeod with Sheila Rogers, recorded in Santa Fe on February 11, 2004. Canadian Alistair MacLeod has published three collections of short stories, each story a polished jewel, and a novel, No Great Mischief. In this program, he reads his heartbreaking story, As Birds Bring Forth the Sun, and then joins well-loved Canadian broadcaster Sheila Rogers in conversation about his work.
Thank you, and good evening. My name's Sheila Rogers. I'm a broadcaster in Canada. And hi, Mom. So glad you could make it. And part of my vocation, I tend to interview writers. I first encountered the man of this evening in 1989. I went to the East Coast province of Nova Scotia. If you don't, okay, I guess you know where Nova Scotia is, but if you don't, think of north of Boston, and it's that piece of geography that sticks out of the east end of Canada that looks like a tail of a whale. And we were going to do a national program about the arts in that part of the country. And a friend of mine said, you've absolutely got to talk to Alistair MacLeod. And my response was, Alistair who? This was, may I remind you, 1989. But I felt that a Nova Scotian couldn't be wrong about a writer from Nova Scotia. And so we booked this Alistair MacLeod. And I started to read his stories, beginning with the title story from As Birds Bring Forth the Sun. This is the story, if you haven't yet read it, in its simplest level, about a man and a dog. And its ending is so profoundly tragic that I found myself gasping for air and wanting to read everything this Alistair MacLeod had ever written, which, as you may know, was not and is not a lot. But at that time, it meant only another slim volume of short stories called The Lost Salt Gift of Blood. They are stories that break your heart, and we want him to do it to us again and again. From first reading, I became something of a missionary. The writer Margaret Lawrence had a wonderful way to simplify Christmas shopping. Take a book you love and give it to all your friends. I passed out his short story collections as though they were religious tracts. The novel was harder to put into a stocking. His name would pop up on my broadcasts when I talked about family, as in, as Alistair MacLeod says, always look after your own blood. But that's a maxim that's almost a threat sometimes, you know. Or talking about immigration. Alistair MacLeod has a line about a great-great-great-grandmother, quote, never able to arrive at the new land nor get back to the old, unquote. Or about memory, you can't unknow what you know. I remember Alistair from a few years ago reading from his then unpublished novel, the one that became No Great Mischief, the one that he had worked on for 11 or 12 years. And the chapter was typed on faded white paper, and from my vantage point on stage, I could see the stain of a rusted paperclip in the left-hand corner. What he read begins as a tender family tableau about a family crossing ice to get to the other side. But then the parents crash through the ice and ultimately drown. As Alistair spooled on in his reading, the audience was moved to tears. And in particular, I'll never forget three Muslim women who were sitting in the front row just sobbing into their hijabs. I've known Alistair now then for about 15 years, and most of that time it was before he became the award-winning, best-selling author. Not that his well-deserved fame has changed him much. When he was nominated for the Wealthy Impact Award, this is the Irish prize that's worth about, $172,000 Canadian, and what's that? About 50,000 American? he told me that if he were to win, he would be able to buy a few pizzas and pay his income tax. And I think with the Lannan Award, he bought a few more pizzas. And he still drives, as he has for almost 20 years, an old boat of a car, a 1988 Crown Victoria. And if you read his stories carefully, you'll see that the car of choice most often is a Crown Victoria. Alistair once described how writing fit into his life while he was a university professor, a husband, and father of six children. He said, "I thought of it the way somebody who can sing may think of their abilities and say, well, I can sing, or I can catch a baseball, but I don't think that I will ever make my living at it. And I haven't made my living at it. I made my living basically as a university professor, but I always liked to write." Well, thank God for that. Ladies and gentlemen, it's an honor to present to you from Canada, Alistair MacLeod. That's the hard part. Oh, thank you. Thank you.
Well, I'd like to thank Sheila Rogers for the introduction, and I'd like to thank all of you people for coming here. Snowy.
Oh, thank you. Right.
I recognize snow.
Thanks.
I'm very glad that you made the effort. I think what I'm going to do this evening, I had 40 minutes, now I have 39 minutes and 36 seconds. Is that I'll read one short story just to show that I can complete something, and then I'll read excerpts, some excerpts from the novel, and I'm going to read this short story that Sheila mentioned, as birds bring forth the sun, and this is what I was trying to do in the story. Some of the things I was trying to do in the story. Sometimes people who live in a certain place for a long time know an awful lot about themselves. And if you have this kind of knowledge about yourself or past generations, it may be good and it may be bad, but it is knowledge. And once you have knowledge, it's very hard to get rid of it, even if you want to. And I was thinking before coming here, it's something like the situation sometimes of adopted children, you know, who go forth to seek their biological parents, and then sometimes they find their biological parents, and the biological parents are terrible people, and they wish they had never discovered them. But, you know, in Oedipus Rex-like fashion, once you know these things, you cannot not know them. And sometimes also in terms of what you may or may not know about your past, if, let's say, you're a woman and your great-grandmother died when she was 48 and your grandmother died when she was 48 and your mother died when she was 48 and you're 47 and you don't feel so well, this knowledge will haunt you in a certain way. The other thing I was interested in is sometimes belief is kind of lapse into superstition, or it works the other way. And I read somewhere the other day that all religions to non-religious people are superstitions. Mm. You know, that if you're within the circle of belief, what you do is normal. But if you're outside the circle of belief, you say, aren't they strange? You know, they only eat certain things and they wear certain clothes and so on. But they're not strange at all to themselves. So blah, blah, blah. So I will begin to read this story now, as birds bring forth the sun. Once there was a family with a Highland name who lived beside the sea, and the man had a dog of which he was very fond. She was large and gray and a sort of staghound from another time. And if she jumped up to lick his face, which she loved to do, the man would push back upon his heels, and he himself was not a small man, being close to 6 feet tall and weighing about 180 pounds. She had been left when a pup at the family's gate in a small handmade box, and no one knew where she had come from or that she would eventually grow to such a size. Once, while still a small pup, she had been run over by the steel wheels of a horse-drawn cart which was hauling kelp from the shore to be used as fertilizer. It was in October, and the rain had been falling for some weeks, and the ground was soft. When the wheel of the cart passed over her, it sunk her body into the wet earth, as well as crushing some of her ribs. And apparently the silhouette of her small, crushed body was visible in the earth. After the man lifted her to his chest while she yelped and screamed, he ran his fingers along her broken bones, ignoring the blood and urine which fell upon his shirt, trying to soothe her bulging eyes and her scrabbling front paws and her desperately licking tongue. The more practical members of his family, who had seen run-over dogs before, suggested that her neck be broken by his strong hands, or that he grasp her by the hind legs and swing her head against a rock, thus putting an end to her misery. But he would not do it. Instead, he fashioned a small box and lined it with woolen remnants from a sheep's fleece and one of his old and frayed shirts. He placed her within the box and placed the box behind the stove, and then he warmed some milk in a small saucepan and sweetened it with sugar. And he held open her small and trembling jaws with his left hand while spooning in the sweetened milk with his right, ignoring the needle-like sharpness of her small teeth. She lay in the box most of the remaining fall and into the early winter, watching everything with her large brown eyes. Although some members of the family complained about her presence and the odor from the box and the waste of time she involved, they gradually adjusted to her, and as the weeks passed by, it became evident that her ribs were knitting together in some form or other and that she was recovering with the resilience of the young. It also became evident that she would grow to a tremendous size, as she outgrew one box and then another, and the gray hair began to feather from her huge front paws. In the spring, she was outside almost all of the time and followed the man everywhere. And when she came inside during the following months, she had grown so large that she would no longer fit into her accustomed place behind the stove and was forced to lie beside it. She was never given a name, but was referred to in Gaelic as Cumhur Gwas, the big gray dog. By the time she came into her first heat, she had grown to a tremendous height, and although her signs and her odor attracted many panting and highly aroused suitors, none was big enough to mount her, and the frenzy of their disappointment and the longing of her unfulfillment were more than the man could stand. He went, so the story goes, to a place where he knew there was a big dog, a dog not as big as she was, but still a big dog, and he brought him home with him. And at the proper time, he took the Cumhur Gwas and the big dog down to the sea, where he knew there was a hollow in the rock, which appeared only at low tide. He took some sacking to provide footing for the male dog, and he placed the Cumhur Gwas in the hollow of the rock and knelt beside her and steadied her with his left arm under her throat and helped position the male dog above her and guided his blood-engorged penis. He was a man used to working with the breeding of animals, with the guiding of rams and bulls and stallions, and often with the funky smell of animal semen, heavy on his large and gentle hands. The winter that followed was a cold one, and ice formed on the sea, and frequent squalls and blizzards obliterated the offshore islands and caused the people to stay near their fires much of the time, mending clothes and nets and harness and waiting for the change in season. The Cumhur Gwas grew heavier and even larger, and there was hardly room for her around the stove or under the table. And then one morning, when it seemed the spring was about to break, she was gone. The man, and even his family, who had become more involved than they cared to admit, waited for her, but she did not come. And as the frenzy of spring wore on, they busied themselves with readying their land and their fishing gear and all of the things that so desperately required their attention. And then they were into summer and fall and winter and another spring, which saw the birth of the man and his wife's 12th child. And then it was summer again. That summer, the man and two of his teenage sons were pulling their herring nets about 2 miles offshore when the wind began to blow off the land and the water began to roughen. They became afraid that they could not make it safely back to shore, so they pulled in behind one of the offshore islands, knowing that they would be sheltered there and planning to outwait the storm. As the prow of their boat approached the gravelly shore, they heard a sound above them, and looking up, they saw the Cumhur Gwas silhouetted on the brow of the hill, which was the small island's highest point. "Methal, Cumhur Gwas," shouted the man in his happiness, "Methal meaning something like dear or darling. And as he shouted, he jumped over the side of his boat into the waist-deep water, struggling for footing on the rolling gravel as he waded eagerly and awkwardly toward her and the shore. At the same time, the Kumar Gwas came hurtling down toward him in a shower of small rocks dislodged by her feet. And just as he was emerging from the water, she met him as she used to, rearing up on her hind legs and placing her huge front paws on his shoulders while extending her eager tongue. The weight and speed of her momentum met him as he tried to hold his balance on the sloping angle with the water rolling gravel beneath his feet, and he staggered backwards and lost his footing and fell beneath her force. And in that instant, again, as the story goes, there appeared over the brow of the hill six more huge gray dogs hurtling down towards the gravel strand. They had never seen him before, and seeing him stretched prone beneath their mother, they misunderstood, like so many armies, the intention of their leader. They fell upon him in a fury, slashing his face and tearing aside his lower jaw and ripping out his throat, crazed with bloodlust or duty or perhaps starvation. The Kumar Gwas turned on them in her own savagery, slashing, snarling, and it seemed crazed by their mistake, driving them bloodied and yelping before her, back over the brow of the hill, where they vanished from sight, but still could be heard, screaming in the distance. It all took, perhaps, little more than a minute. The man's two sons, who were still in the boat and had witnessed it all, ran sobbing through the salt water to where their mauled and mangled father lay, but there was little they could do other than hold his warm and bloodied hands for a few brief moments. Although his eyes lived for a small fraction of time, he could not speak to them because his face and throat had been torn away, and of course there was nothing they could do except to hold and be held tightly until that too slipped away and his eyes glazed over and they could no longer feel his hands holding theirs. The storm increased and they could not get home, and so they were forced to spend the night huddled beside their father's body. They were afraid to try to carry the body to the rocking boat because he was so heavy, and they were afraid that they might lose even what little of him remained. And they were afraid also, huddled on the rocks, that the dogs might return. But they did not return at all, and there was no sound from them, no sound at all, only the moaning of the wind and the washing of the water on the rock. In the morning they debated whether they should try to take his body with them, or whether they should leave it and return in the company of older and wiser men. But they were afraid to leave it unattended, and felt that the time needed to cover it with protective rocks would be better spent in trying to get across to their home shore. For a while they debated as to whether one should go in the boat and the other remain on the island, but each was afraid to be alone. And so in the end they managed to drag and carry and almost float him towards the bobbing boat. They laid him face down and covered him with what clothes there were and set off across the still rolling sea. Those who waited on the shore missed the large presence of the man within the boat, and some of them waded into the water and others rowed out in skiffs, attempting to hear the tearful messages called out across the rolling waves. The Kumar Gwas and her six young dogs were never seen again. Perhaps I should say they were never seen again in the same way. After some weeks, a group of men circled the island tentatively in their boats, but they saw no sign. They went again and then again, but found nothing. A year later, and grown much braver, they beached their boats and walked the island carefully, looking into the small sea caves and the hollows at the base of the wind-ripped trees, thinking perhaps that if they did not find the dogs, they might at least find their whitened bones, but again, they discovered nothing. The Kumar Gwas, though, was supposed to be sighted here and there for a number of years, seen on a hill in one region, or silhouetted on a ridge in another, or loping across the valleys or glens in the early morning or the shadowy evening, always in the area of the half-perceived. For a while she became rather like the Loch Ness Monster or the Sasquatch on a smaller scale, seen but not recorded, seen when there were no cameras, seen but never taken. The mystery of where she went became entangled with the mystery of when she came. There was increased speculation about the handmade box in which she had been found, and much theorizing as to the individual or individuals who might have left it. People went to look for the box, but could not find it. It was felt she might have been part of a buchak or evil spell cast on the man by some mysterious enemy. But no one could go much farther than that. All of his caring for her was recounted over and over again, and nobody missed any of the ironies. What seemed literally known was that she had crossed the winter ice to have her pups and had been unable to get back. No one could remember ever seeing her swim, and in the early months at least, she could not have taken her young pups with her. The large and gentle man with the smell of animal semen, often heavy on his hands, was my great-great-great-grandfather, and it may be argued that he died because he was too good at breeding animals, or that he cared too much about their fulfillment and well-being. He was no longer there for his own child of the spring, who in turn became my great-great-grandfather, and he was perhaps too much there in the memory of his older sons, who saw him fall beneath the ambiguous force of the Kumarguas. The youngest boy in the boat was haunted and tormented by the awfulness of what he had seen. He would wake at night screaming that he had seen the Kumarguas, a Vaj, the big gray dog of death, and his screams filled the house and the ears and the minds of the listeners, bringing home again and again the consequences of their loss. One morning after a night in which he saw the Kumarguas, the Vaj, so vividly that his sheets were drenched with sweat, he walked to the high cliff which faced the island, and there he cut his throat with a fish knife and fell into the sea. The other brother lived to be 40, but again, so the story goes, he found himself in a Glasgow pub one night, perhaps looking for answers, deep and sodden with the whiskey which had become his anesthetic. In the half-darkness, he saw a large gray-haired man sitting by himself against the wall and mumbled something to him. Some say he saw the Kumarguas, the Vaj, or uttered the name, and perhaps the man heard the phrase through ears equally affected by drink, and felt he was being called a dog or a son of a bitch or something of that nature. They rose to meet one another and struggled outside into the cobblestone passageway behind the pub where, most improbably, there were supposed to be six other large gray-haired men who beat him to death on those cobblestones, smashing his head into the stone again and again before vanishing and leaving him to die with his face turned to the sky. The Kumarguas of Vaj had come again, said his family, as they tried to piece the tale together. This is how the Kumarguas of Vaj came into our lives, and it is obvious that all of this happened a long, long time ago. Yet with succeeding generations, it seemed the specter had somehow come to stay, that it had become ours, not in the manner of an unwanted skeleton in the closet from a family's ancient past, but more in the manner of something close to a genetic possibility. In the deaths of each generation, the gray dog was seen by some, by women who were to die in childbirth, by soldiers who went forth to the many wars but did not return, by those who went forth to feuds or dangerous love affairs, by those who answered mysterious midnight messages, by those who swerved on the highway to avoid the real or imagined gray dog and ended in masses of crumpled steel, and by one professional athlete who, in addition to his ritualized athletic superstitions, carried another fear or belief as well. Many of the man's descendants moved like careful hemophiliacs, fearing that they carried unwanted possibilities deep within them. And others, while they laughed, were like members of families in which there is a recurrence over the generations of repeated cancer or the diabetes that comes to those beyond middle age. The feeling of those who may say little to others, but who may say often and quietly to themselves, it has not happened to me, while adding always the cautionary, yet. I am thinking all of this now as the October rain falls on the city of Toronto, and the pleasant white-clad nurses pad confidently in and out of my father's room. He lies quietly amidst the whiteness, his head and shoulders elevated, so that he is in that hospital position of being neither quite prone nor yet sitting. His hair is white upon his pillow, and he breathes softly and sometimes unevenly, although it is difficult ever to be sure. My five gray-haired brothers and I take turns sitting beside his bedside, holding his heavy hands in ours and feeling their response, hoping ambiguously that he will speak to us, although we know that it may tire him. and trying to read his life and trying to read his life and ours into his eyes when they are open. He has been with us for a long time, well into our middle age. Unlike those boys in that boat of so long ago, we did not see him taken from us in our youth. And unlike their youngest brother, who in turn became our great-great-grandfather, we did not grow into a world in which there was no father's touch. We have been lucky to have this large and gentle man so deep into our lives. No one in this hospital has mentioned the Kumar Gua Savage. Yet as my mother said 10 years ago, before slipping into her own death, as quietly as a grown-up child who leaves or enters her parents' house in the early hours, it is hard to not know what you do know. Even those who are most skeptical, like my oldest brother, who has driven here from Montreal, betray themselves by their nervous actions. I avoided the Greyhound bus stations in both Montreal and Toronto. He smiled upon his arrival and then added, just in case. He did not realize how ill our father was and has smiled little since then. Watching him turning the diamond ring upon his finger, knowing that he hopes he will not hear the Gaelic phrase he knows too well, not having the luxury, as he once said, of some who live in Montreal and are able to pretend they do not understand the other language. You cannot not know what you do know. Sitting here, taking turns, holding the hands of the man who gave his life, we are afraid for him and for ourselves. We are afraid of what he may see, and we are afraid to hear the phrase born of the vision. We are aware that it may become confused with what the doctors call the will to live, and we are aware that some beliefs are what others would dismiss as garbage. We are aware that there are men who believe the earth is flat and that the birds bring forth the sun. Bound here in our own peculiar mortality, we do not wish to see or see others see that which signifies life's demise. We do not want to hear the voice of our father, as did those other sons, calling down his own particular death upon him. We would shut our eyes and plug our ears, even as we know such actions to be of no avail. Open still and fearful to the gray hair rising on our necks, if and when we hear the scrabble of the paws and the scratching at the door. And I'll read some, I'm looking at my time, I'll read some little cobbled pieces I put together from this novel, No Great Mischief. And when I began this novel, I wanted to explore the concept of belief or loyalty and, you know, the ripples that go out from that. And a lot of it is it deals with history and what's happened to people in their past and, you know, how they carry that with them. The narrator of this novel is an orthodontist. And I chose the orthodontist because it's a very modern profession. And because so much of this is historical, I thought, well, I'll have this profession that wasn't really there 40 years ago, because 40 years ago there really wasn't an orthodontist. And I wanted the orthodontist to be rich, and orthodontists are rich, and orthodontists get rich by looking after the teeth and the jawlines of other rich people. Poor people never go to the orthodontist. Really poor people never even go to the dentist. But, and the other thing I liked about the profession is you can change people's smile and their jawlines and so on, but they can still be rats inside. So you can have like a nice smiling rat. The other side of that, of course, is that what orthodontists do is, you know, they give people confidence, and make people feel good about themselves and so on. But my man, my narrator, wasn't always an orthodontist. They are made, not born. And so I'm going to read a little section of something that happened to the orthodontist and his family when he was a child. And this is set in my mind in about 1946 or 47 or 48 or something, kind of after the Second World War. And these family are lighthouse keepers on a lighthouse on an island. And the way you get back and forth from the mainland to the island is by boat. But in winter at this time of year, the water is ice covered. It's a combination of drift ice, which comes down from the eastern Arctic, and what they call made ice. Salt water is reluctant to freeze, but it will freeze if it gets enough encouragement. So once the ice comes in, people can kind of walk back and forth. So it's kind of like a miracle. You can kind of walk on water, kind of, you know. So I'm going to read two or three sections of that, of this. Looking at my watch, at my timer. There are three or four Gaelic phrases in here, none of them very profound. One of them is Quán Calam Rua, and Quán is spelled C-L-A-N-N. It's where the word clan comes from. And Quán Calam Rua means the extended family of the red-haired Calam or the red-headed Malcolm. And Gillibeck Rua means the little boy with the red hair, the little red-headed boy. And Maithil means something like dear, darling. And Cú is the Gaelic word for dog. He scrambles around. All right. My twin sister and I were the youngest children in our family, and we were three on March 28th when it was decided that we would spend the night with our grandparents. On the morning of March 28th, which was the beginning of a weekend, my parents and their six children and their dog walked ashore across the ice. Their older sons, who were 16, 15, and 14, apparently took turns carrying my sister and me upon their shoulders, stopping every so often to take off their mitts and rub our faces so that our cheeks would not become so cold as to be frozen without our realizing it. Our father, accompanied by our brother Colin, who was 11, walked ahead of us, testing the ice from time to time with a long pole, although there did not seem much need to do so, for he had bushed the ice some 2 months earlier, meaning he had placed spruce trees upright in the snow and ice to serve as a sort of road guide for winter travelers. My parents welcomed the winter ice because it allowed them to do so many practical things that were more difficult to accomplish in the summer. They could truck their supplies over the ice without the difficulty of first hauling everything to the wharf and then trying to load it on the boat which swayed below. And then, after transporting it across to the island, having to hoist it up out of the boat to the wharf's cap, and then again having to transport it up the cliff to the promontory where the lighthouse stood. They took coal and wood across in the winter and walked and traded animals, leading them by their halters across the treacherous and temporary bridge. On March 28th, there was a lot for my family to do. My older brothers were going to visit their cousins in the country, those who still lived in the old Calam Rua houses neighboring the spot which my grandparents had left when they became people of the town. If they could get a ride, they were going to spend the weekend there. Even if they could not get a ride, they were planning to walk, saying that 10 miles on the inland sheltered roads would not be as cold as a mile and a half straight across the ice. My parents were planning to cash my father's paycheck, which they hoped my grandparents had picked up at the post office, and my brother Colin was looking forward to his new parka, which my mother had shrewdly ordered from the Eaton sale catalog when such heavy winter garments were reduced by the coming promise of spring. He had been hoping for it since before Christmas. My sister and I were looking forward to the visit with our grandparents, who always made a great to-do about us and always told us how smart we were to make such a great journey from such a far and distant place. And the dog knew where she was going to, picking her way across the ice carefully and sometimes stopping to gnaw off the balls of snow and ice which formed between the delicate pads of her hardened paws. Everything went well, and the sun shone brightly as we journeyed forth together, walking first upon the ice so we could later walk upon the land. In the late afternoon, the sun still shone, and there was no wind, but it began to get very cold, the kind of deceptive cold that can fool those who confuse the shining of the winter sun with warmth. Relatives visiting my grandparents' house said that my brothers had arrived at their destination and would not be coming back until perhaps the next day. My parents distributed their purchases into haversacks, which were always at my grandparents' house, and which they used for carrying supplies upon their backs. Because my parents' backs would be burdened, and because my brothers were not there, it was decided that my sister and I would spend the night, and that our brothers would take us back to the island when they returned. It was suggested that Colin also might stay, but he was insistent that he go, so that he might test the long-anticipated warmth of the new parka. When they left, the sun was still shining, although it had begun to decline, and they took two storm lanterns, which might serve as lights or signs and signals for the last part of the trip. My mother carried one and Colin the other, while my father grasped the ice pole in his hand. When they set out, they first had to walk about a mile along the shore until they reached the appropriate place to get on the ice. And then they started across, following the route of the spruce trees which my father had set out. Everyone could see their three dark forms and the smaller one of the dog outlined upon the whiteness over which they traveled. By the time they were halfway across, it was dusk, and out there on the ice they lit their lanterns, and that too was seen from the shore. And then they continued on their way. Then their lanterns seemed to waver and almost to dance wildly, and one described an arc in what was now the darkness, and then was still. Grandpa watched for almost a minute to be sure of what he was seeing, and then he shouted to my grandmother, "There is something wrong out on the ice. There is only one light, and it is not moving." My grandmother came quickly to the window. "Perhaps they stopped," she said. "Perhaps they're resting. Perhaps they had to adjust their packs. Perhaps they had to relieve themselves. But there's only one light," said Grandpa, "and it is not moving at all." "Perhaps that's it," said Grandma, hopefully. "The other light blew out, and they're trying to get it started." My sister were playing on the kitchen floor with Grandma's cutlery. We were playing store, taking turns buying the spoons and knives and forks from each other with a supply of pennies from a jar Grandma kept in her lower cupboard for emergencies. "The light is still not moving," said Grandpa, and he began hurriedly to pull on his winter clothes and boots, even as the phone began ringing. "The light is not moving, the light is not moving," the voices said. "They are in trouble out on the ice." And then the voices spoke in the hurriedness of exchange. "Take a rope, take some ice poles, take a blanket that we can use as a stretcher, take brandy, we will meet you at the corner. Don't start across without us." "I have just bought all the spoons and knives," said my sister proudly from the kitchen floor, "and I still have all these pennies left." "Good for you," said Grandma. "A penny saved is a penny earned." When they were partway to the shore, their lights picked up the dog's eyes, and she ran to Grandpa when he called her in Gaelic, and she leaped up to his chest and his outstretched arms and licked his face, even as he threw his mitts from his hands so he could bury them deep within the fur upon her back. "She was coming to get us," he said. "They've gone under." "Not under," someone said. "Perhaps down, but not under." "I think under," said Grandpa. "She was under anyway. She's soaked to the spine. She's smart and she's a good swimmer and she's got a heavy layered coat. If she's just went down, she'd be down and up in a second, but she's too wet for that. She must have gone down and then the currents carried her under the ice and she had to swim back to the hole to get herself back out." They went out on the ice in single file, the string of their moving lights seeming almost like a kind of Christmas decoration, each light moving to the rhythm of the man who walked and carried in his hand. They followed the tracks and walked towards the light, which remained permanent on the ice. As they neared it, they realized it was sitting on the ice, sitting upright by itself and not held by any hand. The tracks continued until they came to the open water, and then there were no more. Years later, my sister and I were in grade 11, and the teacher was talking to the class about Wordsworth, and as an example, was reading to us from the poem entitled Lucy Gray. When she came to the latter lines, both my sister and I started simultaneously and looked towards each other, as if in the old but new to us, we had stumbled upon the familiar experience. They followed from the snowy bank those footmarks one by one, into the middle of the plank, and further there were none. And further there were none. But on March 28th, we were tiring of our game of store and putting the cutlery away as our grandmother prepared to ready us for bed, while glancing anxiously through the window. Out on the ice, the dog began to whine when they came near the open water, and the first men in the line lay on their stomachs, each holding the feet of the man before him, so that they might form a type of human chain, with their weight distributed more evenly than if they remained standing. But it was of no use, for other than the light, there was nothing, and the ice seemed solid right up to the edge of the dark and sloshing void. There was nothing for the men to do but wonder. Beyond the crater, the rows of spruce trees marched on in ordered single file, in much the same way that they led up to the spot of their interruption. It was thought that, perhaps, only one tree had gone down and under. The section of the ice that had gone was not large, but as my grandfather said, it was more than big enough for us. The tide was going out when they vanished, leaving nothing but a lantern, perhaps tossed onto the ice by a sinking hand. and miraculously landing upright and continuing to glow. Or perhaps set down after its arc, wily but carefully, by a hand which sought to reach another. The men performed a sort of vigil out on the ice, keeping the hole broken open with their ice poles and waiting for the tide to run its course. And in the early hours of the morning, when the tide was in its change, my brother Colin surfaced in one of those half-expected uncertainties known only to those who watch the sea. The white fur hood of his parka broke the surface, and the half-frozen men, who were crouched like patient Inuit around the hole, shouted to one another and reached for him with their poles. They thought that he had not been a great distance under, or that his clothes had snagged beneath the ice, and they thought that, perhaps, since he was not bearing a backpack, he had not been so heavily burdened, and perhaps the new material in his parka possessed flotation qualities that had buoyed him to the top. His eyes were open, and the drawstrings of his hood were still neatly tied and tucked beside his throat in the familiar manner that my mother always used. In the morning, my sister and I were having our porridge, mapping little rivers on its surface for the milk to follow, and sprinkling it too liberally with brown sugar, and still for the most part unaware of what had happened. My grandmother hugged my sister fiercely to her, and my grandfather ruffled my hair. "Poor Gilly Beck Rua," he said. "Things will never, ever again be the same for you." The wake for my brother Colin was held at the home of my grandparents, 2 days and two nights, with the funeral on the third day. Quan Kalamarua came from great distances, as well as from nearby, and it seemed the house would burst. The women sent in vast quantities of food, and there were more than enough men to dig the grave in the frozen, snow-covered cemetery, passing the pick from one to the other and watching the sparks fly up from the frozen earth. When the mourners entered the house, they went immediately to the casket to say their prayers, and then they would turn to offer their condolences. Many of them looked instinctively for my parents, because it was to the parents that one turned when a child was lost. Then they would remember and compose themselves and look for the other closest next of kin. They would go towards my grandparents or my uncles and aunts or my stricken older brothers, embracing the women and shaking hands with the men and saying, "Sorry for your troubles, sorry for your troubles." Throughout much of the wake, many of them, in spite of themselves, kept looking towards the door, as if expecting to see my parents coming in, coming home, called home by a death in the family, but they did not come at all. Throughout the days and nights of the wake, Quan Kalamarua slept on chairs and in the hallways, and sometimes on the floor in bedrooms where the beds were all ready full. And most of them took shifts sitting up all night beside the small corpse of my brother Colin, so he would not be alone. He lay in perfect stillness through it all, but with that type of perfection that still seems somehow to be in waiting, as if waiting for my mother to check his necktie or to make sure his fingernails were clean. As if she were to say, "You will be the center of attention. Everyone will be looking at you." Throughout the day and nights, there was much conversation as to how and why it had all happened. Everyone agreed that my father was a good man on the ice, and it was true that they had crossed over the same route earlier in the day. It was true also that the currents and tides were running freely and had perhaps eaten away more of the underside of the ice than anyone realized. And it was, after all, the end of March, and the sun had been shining, although it did not seem to have been that strong. It all remained somehow most inconclusive. It was generally decided that it was an act of God, as the insurance companies might term it, although Quan Kalamarua referred to it as God's will and trusted in his mercy. Some others who had read or misread the book of Job saw it as an example of God's justice and his punishment and cast about for reasons. Since my parents had taken the job on the island, they had not gone to church as often as they should have. Perhaps they had engaged in premarital sex in the time before their marriage. Who was now to ever know? Who was to find reasons? Others told stories of forerunners, of how they had seen lights out on the ice at the exact spot years before, and of how such harbingers could now be seen as prophecies fulfilled. Throughout the wake, my other grandfather made only irregular appearances because he was not a man for communal mourning, and later he volunteered to cross the ice and look after the island until a permanent replacement could be found. He took his violin with him, and once or twice in the still evenings, and when the wind blew towards the land, it was possible to hear the laments he apparently thought he was playing only to himself. He played better than most people realized he could, and the music was even more haunting to those who understood its source. He played "O'er the Moor Among the Heather," Glenn Coe, and Patrick McCrimmon's "Lament for the Children." "We have suffered a great loss, but we have other children, and we have each other," said Grandma. Nobody knows the depths of that man's sorrow. In the time after the wake, the older Kalamurua men who often sat around my grandparents' kitchen would sometimes offer my sister and me handfuls of coins because they could not think of anything else to do. Sometimes they would refer to us as the lucky children and sometimes as the unlucky children. "Maithal on the little girl," they would say, or "Poor Gilibek Rua, you have a long road ahead of you." They say that beneath the ice, there is always a layer of air between it and the actual water, and that if you are swept under, the thing to do is to try to turn on your back until you can almost press your mouth and nostrils against the underside of the ice, which will at least allow you to breathe. But then you must keep your eyes open so that you can see the hole that you came through and try to work yourself back towards it. If you close your eyes in the freezing salt, you may become disoriented and therefore doomed because you do not have much time. And if the currents are running strongly, they may take you under such a distance and so quickly that your most rapid reaction may prove in the end to be too slow. I have often thought of my parents as upside down beneath the ice, almost the way you see potato bugs on the underside of the leaf, their hands and knees pushing upwards in something resembling a macabre fetal position, trying to press their mouths against the underside of the top which kept them down, trying to breathe in order that they might somehow stay alive. In the weeks that followed their loss, the sun shone brightly and the currents were strong, and the ice turned black beneath its own whiteness, as if eaten by a hidden cancer, which only now began to make itself visible. And within a few days, what had been a white and seeming certain expanse became but a view of bobbing cakes and swirling chunks, turning and reflecting in the light and the gray-blue water. Twice before the breakup, the dog left my grandparents' house and crossed to the island, looking for her people, and twice my uncles crossed to bring her back. The second time, Grandpa tied her with a chain to the doorstep, but she whined or whinged, as they said, so visibly and so mournfully that the next morning Grandpa let her go, because he said she was breaking my heart. Immediately she raced down to the shore and started to cross, running low across the level ice and hurling herself without hesitation into the open water, swimming to the nearest pan and then leaping from one pan to the other while Grandpa watched her progress through his binoculars. "She made it," he said, finally turning from the window. "Poor Koo." She was still there waiting for her vanished people to rise out of the sea when the new lightkeeper, a man from the way of Picto, nudged the prow of his boat against the wharf on the island's rocky shore. She came scrambling down the rocks to meet him with her hackles raised and her teeth bared, protecting what she thought was hers and snarling in her certainty. And he reached into the prow of his boat for his .22 rifle and pumped four bullets into her loyal waiting heart. And later he caught her by the hind legs and threw her body into the sea. "She was descended from the original Kalamrua dog," said Grandpa, when he heard the news, pouring himself a water glass full of whiskey, which he drank without a flinch, "the one who swam after the boat when they were leaving Scotland. It was in those dogs," he said, "to care too much and to try too hard." On May 15th, my other grandfather came across his daughter's purse while on one of his early morning walks along the shore. It was still clasped tightly, and inside it there was not much of value or interest to the larger world. There was a $10 bill wrapped tightly within a handkerchief, and the sales slip and guarantee for Collins Parka, in case it should not prove to be quite adequate. This is the story of how my sister and I, as three-year-old children, planned to spend the night with our grandparents and remained instead for 16 years until we left to go to university. This is a story of lives which turned out differently than was intended, and obviously much of this information is not really mine at all, not in the sense that I experienced it, for, as I said, while our parents were drowning, my sister and I were playing store, and in the generations a long time before, we did not see Kalamrua's faithful dog swimming after her family to a life beyond the sea. And we did not see our great-great-great-grandmother, the former Catherine McPherson, sewn into a canvas bag and thrown also into that same sea. But still, whatever its inaccuracies, this information has come to be known in the manner that family members come to know one another because they share such close proximity. Or as Grandma would say, how could you not know that? There are a lot of things I don't know, said Grandma, but there are some things I really believe in. I believe you should always look after your blood. If I did not believe that, she would say, where would you two be? On Monday morning, my office will be filled, as it was on Friday, with those who wish to be more beautiful. Some are children whose parents have made their appointments for them. Some are referrals made by friends and colleagues who practice the more basic forms of dentistry. Others have sought me out from considerable distances in the hope that I might give them what they want and think they need. There are some who would wish to alter their jawlines so that they might look more like current pop stars. Sometimes they bring pictures of who they would hope to be along with them. Shyly, they bring their pictures forth from within their purses or from the inside pockets of their expensive jackets. You really do not need this, I say to some of them. Think of the future. If this were to happen, you might find out it is not really what you want at all. I look at them carefully, as might the doctor advising the young man against a vasectomy. Quietly, we talk about the consequences and the expectations. In some cases, we talk more basically about the impacted wisdom tooth, the mesiodens, and the supernumerary teeth of children. I give them leaflets with titles such as What May Happen After the Removal of an Impacted Tooth, or Advice Following Oral Surgery. The leaflets contain headings such as pain, swallowing, swelling, along with advice on medication. Quote, to reduce the density of pain, you must take the medication which is prescribed. Follow the instructions exactly. Do not wait for the pain to become too severe before taking the prescribed tablets. Otherwise, it may become more difficult to control. Should the pain become too intense, please notify this office immediately. Or, quote, do not rinse the mouth until the following morning, and then only gently. Rinsing too early and or too frequently may prevent clotting and also healing. When rinsing, use warm salt water, which will help to flush out food particles lodged in the operated area. Half a teaspoon of salt in a glass of lukewarm water. If in doubt, do not hesitate. Call this office or under the heading complications which may occur. Sometimes the hole left behind after the molar's removal may remain for some time. Gradually it should fill in with bone and new tissue. Sometimes, as healing advances, small sharp splinters may work up to the tissue and be a source of discomfort and unexpected pain. Gradually, though, they should disappear. If in doubt, do not hesitate to call this office. Mm-hmm. I think of my grandparents a great deal, and as in the manner of the remembered Gaelic songs, I do not do so consciously. I do not awake in the morning and say, as soon as my feet hit the floor, today I must remember Grandma and Grandpa. I will devote 10 whole minutes to their memory, as if I were anticipating isometric exercises or a self-imposed number of push-ups to be done on the floor beside my bed. It does not work that way at all. But they drift into my mind in the midst of the quiet affluence of my office, where there is never supposed to be any pain, but only the creation of a hopeful beauty. And they drift into the quiet affluence of my home with its sunken living room and its luxuriously understated furniture. And they are there too, on Grand Cayman, or in Montego Bay, or Sarasota, or Tenerife, or any of those other places to which we go, trying to pretend that for us there really is no winter. They drift in like the fine snow in the old Kalamrua house in which my brothers used to live, sifting in and around the window casings or under the doors, driven by the insistent and unseen wind, so that in spite of primitive weather stripping or the stuffing with old rags, it continued to persist, forming lines of quiet whiteness to be greeted with surprise. Thanks very much.
That concludes the reading for this event. Next up is the conversation.
Thank you, and thank you, Alistair, for reading all the parts that really make me cry. So I'm just sitting here kind of like this, all a twitter. I'd also like to very much thank the Lannan Foundation for bringing Alistair here tonight and the fact that he would invite me along as a sidekick. And I guess, first of all, to say congratulations to you on the Lannan Award. That's a very nice thing. Did you buy a new car?
No.
No? Are you ever going to buy a new car?
No.
No.
When Sheila was talking about the car before, I do still have this kind of 1988 car. And I live part of the year in Windsor, Ontario, which is right across the river from Detroit. So I fly out of Detroit very often. And sometimes my children come to meet me at the Detroit airport. And there's always the question of crossing the border. So I say to them, you know, how'd you get along on the border? And they said, oh, okay. But the customs man said, who owns this car? And they say, my father owns this car. We're going to get him at the airport. And that's fine. But when I drive the car, they never say who owns this car. Because I just look like the car. They just look at me and they look at the car and they say, we know who we've got here. Just go on your way. Anyway.
The car stays. In
well,
other words.
Well, we'll see. Nothing lasts forever.
I want to ask you a question that somehow I've never asked you before, and I've done a number of, actually it's a second career for me to interview you, but when you were young, did you have any idea of what you wanted to be when you grew up?
No, I don't think so. But I always liked to go to school, you know. I really did like to go to school. And I was the kind of person who won the literature prize in grade 12 and so on, you know. So I always liked books and I always liked reading and I always liked to be a part of literature. But I wasn't thinking, you know, in 50 years, here I'll be in Santa Fe at the Lannan Foundation. I didn't have that kind of extended vision. Yeah.
You often write in your stories about parents' expectations of their kids, and sometimes the parents want them to leave the life that they have lived, or the parents have a fear of book learning, and that will stop them from living the life that the family has always lived. What expectations did your parents have of you?
Well, I don't think they had very many expectations. I don't think they had very many expectations. I think I just wanted to do this type of thing, and I suppose what one should be appreciative of is that no one tried to stop me, you know. So that's the kind of gift, you know, rather than sort of saying, you know, you better go into physics or something like that, or become an orthodontist. You know, this is the future.
But Alistair, did they have orthodontists?
No, they didn't have orthodontists. Terrible dentists, you know. I think that sometimes if parents just leave you alone, it's good rather than nagging you all the time. But I don't know.
What books meant a lot to you when you were young?
I never can answer that question, but I always like to read. And I was thinking today, I love to read Zane Grey books, you know. All those cowboy stories, I said, they were all kind of probably around here. Wild Horse Mesa, who knows, you know, maybe it's close by. Here I am in New Mexico. But I always like to read, and still when people ask me today, like, what are you reading now, I never can really answer that very well or in terms of influences. But it's obviously a very good thing to read, and the more you read, the more you know, of course. And so I think you just put a lot of stuff into your head, and then maybe when you start to write, a lot of that stuff is in there, and you don't always remember how it got there or the circumstances, but it is yours, you know?
Did you hear a lot of stories when you were growing up?
I heard some stories, yes, I heard some stories. I grew up basically in a kind of Gaelic-speaking culture, although our family came from Scotland, and our whole area came, people in that area came in 1791, so that's a long, long time ago, you know. But when we came to that area of Canada, there was nobody else there except the indigenous native people, and there were not very many of them. And so, you know, we were largely like a Gaelic-speaking people until probably after the Second World War. Gaelic would be the first language of my parents and of my grandparents or my great-grandparents or my great-great-grandparents. And when I was, say, 10 or 11 or 12 or something like that, my grandfather used to say to me, "Can you understand Gaelic?" And he would say this kind of playfully. He would say, "Can you speak Gaelic?" And I would say, "No, but I can understand it." And he would say, "You're something like the dog," because they used to talk to their dogs in Gaelic all the time, you know. They would say, you know, "Jinsui, Kasaurus, hurry up, lie down, go and get the cows, go get the paper." And the dog would do all these things because they were unilingual Gaelic hearing dogs, you know. But they never said a word, you know. They never had. I don't know if they barked in Gaelic or not, but I remember that. He said, "Well, you're something like the dog. I mean, the dog could understand it, but never responds with rolling oratory or anything like that."
I think when we read you and I know that many people here, I can sense the recognition. We feel that you're in your writing, that you're reading to us, that you're telling us a story, that this is something, you know, oral. And even I think at the beginning of No Great Mischief, the narrator says, "As I will tell you." It's not.
So I begin to tell this story.
How conscious are you of the sound of the story in your reader's head?
I'm conscious of the sound of the story in my own head.
And that's a good start.
I hope it'll be worked that way for the reader. I like to pretend that I'm telling the story. You know, I know it's a false conceit, but storytelling is a lot older than literacy. You know, people were telling stories before they could read and write. And so I like to pretend that I'm telling the story, although obviously 360 pages, you know, you can't get away with this. But I like to believe that I'm telling the story, and I read every sentence aloud to myself because I like to hear what it sounds like. I just don't want to give information, you know, like give directions like you find on a do-it-yourself bookcase or something. You know, I would like to do more than just... give information. And Lord Chesterfield, who lived in the 1700s, said something. He said, "Style is the clothing of thought," or something like that. "Style is the dress of thought," I think. And it's a lovely quotation, because I think what he was saying is it's not just what you have to say that's important, but it's how you clothe your thoughts or whatever you're trying to say before you send it out to the world. So I read everything really carefully. And if it doesn't sound right, I change it till it does sound the way I want it to sound. And then I hope that readers will,
And sometimes that can take a long time.
It takes a while, yeah. And sometimes, you know, I write things. And I remember one story I was writing, and I just loved this word, you know. I said, "Oh, it just sounds so great." But I knew the word didn't mean what it was wrong, you know. So... I went to the old English dictionary, you know, with a magnifying glass. And sometimes, you know, if you look back to Old Norse or Old Frisian, the word would mean almost anything, you know. But it didn't, you know. It's still, you know. But I loved the word so much because it just rolled along the sentence. So I said, "I'm going to use it anyway." You know, because it sounds like this, you know. And I don't know if anyone ever, I never told anybody what it was, and I never will, but I kind of snuck it in there, you know. This is like sacrificing sense for sound, but I just did it because it sounded so nice, you know.
Are you musical?
Kind of, yes, yeah. I think so.
I know you have, I've danced with Alistair, and I can say he has the nimble tread of the feet of Fred Astaire. But
hardly.
but there is. I feel there's a real cadence and a real phrasing.
Yes.
Obviously, these are tools of the craft. But I don't think I've ever heard you sing. And I guess I won't tonight
the
either.
Young. That's not. It may be in your future.
There's also the sense, I feel the sense of a rhythm, too, that reminds me of those old Gaelic. I have a little bit of this in my family, too. The walking songs, when the women would sit around a table and grab the cloth and pound it and mill it into shape. that kind of
work songs.
Yeah, work
they'd be,
songs.
They'd be like sea shanties, you know.
Yeah, exactly. Did you hear, I mean, your family,
your family's
very musical, too.
Yes, they are, yeah. Like all my children, all our children play something. They're in bands and they play different instruments and so on. When I was in Scotland, I lived in Scotland for a year. Canada and Scotland had an exchange program, and Scotland would send a writer to Canada, and Canada would send a writer to Scotland. So my family lived in Scotland for a year. And one of the Scottish people liked the work very much, and I'm very pleased with that. But a broadcaster or someone over there said, we're going to translate the stories back into the original Gaelic, you know?
Yeah.
And I said, there is no original Gaelic. I said, I write them in English. And they said, you write them in English originally? And I said, yes. And they said, well, how can you do that? I don't know. I said, you know? But they've since been translated into Gaelic, and they're on the radio. But it's a sort of a... I guess a kind of rhythm that I'm not really aware of consciously, you know. Although when I put in that false word, I was conscious.
Does the rhythm hold up in Urdu or World Bengali?
I don't know.
I
don't know.
The books have been translated into 15 languages now, which is fantastic.
Yeah. That's interesting because when you write, I think writing is a communicative act. And maybe when you write out of Canada, or maybe when you write out of, you know, a certain area of Canada, you don't say, you know, the Israelis will really like this, the Japanese will really like this, the World Bengalis will really like this, the Turks will really like this, the Albanians will really like this. When translating to those languages, I'm always surprised. I'm not so surprised when it's translated into, you know, Scandinavian languages, lots of water, lots of snow, lots of ice, lots of fish. But Urdu, you know, I say, well, you know, it's very nice. It's very rewarding when you kind of send out your message in a bottle, you know, and the people all over the world pick it up and say, well, I understand this, yeah. You know, I can relate to this. And we want to translate into whatever it may be.
I think it must be very rewarding for you, too, because the sense of place and the landscape and the weather that people live in is central to your stories, and you're sending out that place to other places as well.
Yes, I think that this is what writers do. You write of your particular place, like for the larger world, and you're very pleased when the larger world receives you and understands what you're trying to say.
When did you know that you would write? I mean, and actually send off these stories into the world?
I lived 6 years in the United States, and I went to do a PhD at Notre Dame. And one of the things you do when you do a PhD, and I'm sure there's a lot of you there, you know, you jump through all those hoops, and you pass the German exam, and you pass the French exam, and you pass the Latin exam, and you pass the comprehensives, and you send in your thesis, blah, 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 blah. And you sure analyze a lot of literature, you know. So as I was chugging along, you know, analyzing James Joyce's The Dead and Faulkner's A Rose for Emily for the 3,000th time, you know, writing papers, I began to say, well, maybe instead of just criticizing, you know, other people's literature, which is what a lot of academic people do, instead of just criticizing literature, maybe I should try to create literature, you know, rather than just be a critic of it. Be also a person who creates it. And because I was away from my home landscape, or what I considered my home landscape for a while, I became, I think, more thoughtful about it, you know. Mm. I became more thoughtful. I don't know if it's absence makes the heart grow fonder, but when you're away from the familiar, I wouldn't say it becomes exotic, but you become more thoughtful about it, you know.
Gain
I think
a perspective.
Yes. I think it's like when young people leave home, you know, and they may have terrible homes or they may have wonderful homes, but when they're away, they look back and they say, oh, this is what my parents were really doing, or this is what they were thinking. And I never thought of that then, but now I see these dramas kind of in a different light. And so then I said, well, I'm just going to write these stories. I'm going to do this, and I'm just going to set them in this place. But why not, you know? Because I had studied, as I said, a lot of literature, and a lot of great literature doesn't come from the most fashionable places, you know. And I did a lot of work in 19th century British literature. You know, D.H. Lawrence was in New Mexico. D.H. Mm-hmm. Lawrence was too far north, and Emily Bronte was too far north, and, you know, Thomas Hardy was too far south, and, you know, like, it's like Faulkner's from a funny place, you know, Mississippi. And, but, you know, there's just, like, when you look at literature, there's just so much of it. It can come from any place. So I just set sail with that in mind, and it worked out fine. So.
One of, or a number of, the themes that come up in your stories, they're often about dislocation, and immigration is one of the great stories of the United States, of course, and Canada as well. What perspective do you think being from Cape Breton brings to how you approach dislocation in your stories?
Well, Cape Breton is a very beautiful place, but it's economically challenged. There's never enough work. There's never been enough work for the people who were there. Never enough work for my generation, for my father's generation, for grandfather's generation. But it is a very like close-knit kind of community. So I think what happens to a lot of people who have been in places a long time, you know, people who have been in places a long time, like where the graves are, you know, where your great-great-grandparents, people who have been in a place for a long time, have an attachment to the place, and I think the geography shapes them to a certain extent. And I think very often there's a tension between people who go away to work in places and to do jobs they don't really like for economic reasons. So you're kind of economically pushed-pulled away, and you're economically and you're emotionally kind of push-pulled back. And this is less so now than it used to be, but there are lots of people who work at jobs that they really hate, you know. Mm. They just hate. They hate where they are and they hate what they do, but they have to do it because, you know, they can't all be orthodontists. And maybe the orthodontist hates his work too, his or her work, I don't know. But I think there's that tension, and it's there in all of the eastern provinces, and it's there maybe in a place like Quebec where people have a single language to a large extent, you know, so they want to be where the language is. They couldn't move to New Mexico because they don't speak English, you know. So it's a kind of double-edged sword. So I will stay this way forever, and you say, okay. The good news of that is such and such, and the bad news of that is such and such. So I think people, so a lot of people move around, mm-hmm. and a lot of people stay. So,
have you heard from orthodontists, by the way?
Some.
Yeah?
Yeah.
What'd you hear from them?
They have the highest rate of suicide in Canada of any profession. As do dentists. That's one of the things I hear from them. Yeah. I like them. I like to read their magazines when I was when I was doing this. I read all their magazines, and they're all pressured by, you know, chemical companies to sell products, you know, make teeth out of whatever. I don't know. But I thought it was an interesting profession, you know. And I think my fellow there, he's just somebody who wants to be rich. And if you go to school for a long time, you probably can become rich. You know, if you're going to be an orthodontist, you're going to become a doctor, if you're going to be a PhD, whatever, you know, you go to school for 20 years minimum, and then you become rich. But almost that easy. But for a lot of people in the world, they don't have the luxury, or in the previous generation, they don't have the luxury of going to school for 20 years. You know, they get married when they're 17. Or they go to, you know, pick peaches or something, you know. It's not that they're not smart. It's that they're in a certain situation, and this is your life. And you say, well, I don't like this life. I'm going to often become an orthodontist, you know. But it will take a long time, and it will be hard work. And you say, well, I'm going to do it anyway, and that's okay. And you say, well, I can't do that. I have four children, you know, and I'm 21. I can't do that. Say, okay, you know. But I think these are kind of interesting ideas, like what people do with their time, and what people do with their lives, and what people do with what is given to them, you know.
I want to ask you a question I promised I would never ask you, because you can answer either yes or no. Okay.
Okay.
But it's a what question, so I suppose that might be tricky. But what's the next book?
Oh, I only write one every 60 years. So I'll be 120 by the time the next one comes around. I hope I'm invited back here. Hope you'll all be here.
Yeah. And on that note, we can actually end. I just want to say it. You know, it almost, as some of you will be coming to Alistair's stories for the very first time, and I envy you that experience. But then you'll have the experience of coming back to them and seeing what you missed the first time you read them, and it will just keep on going. It really is a gift that keeps on giving, and. Thank goodness for that. But I want to thank you once again for this. I can't believe, was that 25 minutes? Is this clock right? Really is. We're down past zero, negative zero. Thank
Scary.
You. Thank you again very much. And thank you very
thank
much
you
for
all
your
very much
active
for
attention.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you all very much. Thanks a lot. Thanks.
Keep you here for a long time. All right.
You've been listening to a Lannan podcast. You can subscribe to our podcast at podcast.lannan.org. In addition, the Lannan Audio Archives present similar programs by national and international writers, poets, and social activists at www.lannan.org. Listen to hundreds of hours of recorded programs from the likes of Seamus Haney, Joy Harjo, Eduardo Galeano, Arundhati Roy, Jim Harrison, Edwige Dantica, and Noam Chomsky. New programs are added every month to both the podcast and the audio archives.